Hi, everybody. My name is Karen, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 4th, 1990. I'm also known as Tootsie Roll Pop Karen, because whenever you see me at a meeting, I'm sucking on one of these suckers. I actually have two home groups. My first one is in a little town just outside of Kalamazoo. It's called the West Ashtamo Group, and we meet every Wednesday at 7. And then in the summer, my husband and I live at a cottage about an hour from Kalamazoo in a little town on a little lake, and we have a home group there that's called the Centerville Bulldog Meeting. And that meeting meets at 7 at Tuesdays and Thursdays. I would like to thank the General Service Board and the Conference Committee for giving me this fantastic honor to be on a panel. It's double honor because my husband, Tom Kay, who's also in the program, is also going to be on a panel. And his panel is the very last one in the program. It's We Realize We Know Only a Little. It's Saturday at 3:30. I hear it's going to be a pretty good panel, almost as good as this one. So, living sober. When I first heard that that was going to be the topic of the panel I was going to be on, the first thing I thought of was this little yellow book, Living Sober, Some Methods AA Members Have Used for Not Drinking. When I was new, I was told that after the big book and after the 12 and 12, that this was the most important book to read, mainly because it gives common sense answers to how to deal with life on life's terms. I also have seen that the newest edition of the little yellow book is now blue. I have a bit of a resentment about that. The powers that be messed with my book, and now how am I going to tell people to read the little yellow book? Speaking of resentments, don't get me started on what they did to 449. But I digress. Anyway, I got sober, and then the next question is, I'm sober, now what? It says here in the book, anyone could get sober. We have all done it lots of times. The trick is to stay and to live sober. I actually got sober in a treatment center. It was a 28-day program. When I got out of there, they told me that that was just a jump start into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me what they called a mental toolbox, and they told me if I wanted to stay sober, I had to use that toolbox. My husband had turned 40 not long before I got sober, and I had gotten him a mug, and on the mug it said, "You have just turned 40, and you will never have fun again for as long as you live." When I was in treatment, I kept thinking of that mug, and I kept thinking, "You have just gotten sober, and you will never have fun again for as long as you live." Well, it turns out I was very, very wrong. My life in sobriety is a lot more fun than I ever could have imagined. But it wasn't that way at first for me. It was hard for me at first. Getting sober and staying sober was a real struggle for me, mainly because I'm different from the rest of you people. Oh, I am. I have problems none of you could imagine. I had irrational fears, phobias, panic attacks. One of my big phobias, by the way, is public speaking. Here I am. So we've all heard the term terminal uniqueness, and I definitely suffered from that because I thought I was different. And there was a time when I drank to deal with all those fears. So after I got sober, it was, okay, now what am I going to do? I'm going to be sober, but I'm never going to have fun. I'm never going to enjoy life. How am I ever going to learn how to deal with all my problems? So I thought about that toolbox because I needed a new way. And one of the tools I found was a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And the premise of this book was, no matter how scared you are to do something, you just go ahead and do it with the fear, and eventually the fear will go away. So I started using that method. One of my biggest fears was tornadoes. And whenever there was a tornado watch or tornado warning in my drinking days, I would get in my shower with a mattress over my head, a bottle in one hand, a cigarette in another hand, and I would drink and smoke until the storm warning or watch passed. So I needed a new way. And since I got sober in January, I thought, my gosh, in Michigan, our tornado season starts in April. It was only a few months away. And I thought, what am I going to do? Well, the first time there was a tornado watch while I was at work, and my office, fortunately, was only 5 minutes from the Alano Club in Kalamazoo. So I got off of work that day, went straight to the Alano Club instead of going home, and I sat there and waited out the storm in a safe environment. So that was my new way of dealing with that. And slowly my fear of tornadoes and storms has gotten better. In fact, just a couple weeks ago in Kalamazoo, we had a big tornado outbreak. There was one that touched down not too far from where I live. And I was just sitting there that evening watching TV, watching all the storm updates and so forth, perfectly calm. And I thought, my gosh, I've come a long way. I can't believe I'm doing this. Another one of my big fears was fear of flying. When I flew, in my drinking days was very rare. And if I did fly, I did it by having a lot to drink before I got on the plane and a lot to drink while I was on the plane and a lot to drink while I was wherever I went. So I thought, I'll never fly again. I thought, there's no way. But after I had been sober maybe 6-7 years, my husband announced that he was going to go to his niece's wedding in Portland, Oregon. And I got pissed. I said, how dare you? You're going to go without me. I'll show you. If you're going, I'm going to go too. So first thing I did was I got my will in order because I was sure I was going to die. I got on that plane, and I cried all the way there. And I got there, and the first thing we did was we went to a meeting, and I cried in the meeting. And I said, I can't believe I'm at a meeting in Portland, Oregon. My husband said it was the dumbest thing he ever did, get me on that first plane, because then there was no stopping me. We fly a lot now. We go a lot of places, and I am not afraid of flying anymore. The first few years when I flew, I would fly afraid, but eventually the fear went away, and now I actually enjoy flying. When I was like about 10 years sober, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Well, how do you deal with that one sober? Well, what I did was I went to lots of meetings, I talked about it a lot, and I took it one day at a time. And I was very lucky because I was diagnosed early and they caught it early. So after I got through all my treatments, I am now cancer-free. Another medical issue I have to deal with was a couple years after I got sober, I began to experience tremors, and I was diagnosed with a condition called cervical dystonia, which causes tremors in my head. There's not a lot they can do about it. I just kind of have to live with it. I've had to learn to practice a lot of acceptance. I do get treatments, though, where they put Botox shots in the back of my neck. And if you look back there, you'll see that there's not any wrinkles back there. You know, it hasn't been all bad. There's a lot of fun things that have happened in sobriety, too. And I really think it's equally important to learn how to live sober and deal with and celebrate the good stuff in addition to the bad stuff. I am actually retired now, and so my husband and I get to travel quite a bit, and I really enjoy traveling. This is actually our 4th international convention. The first one was Minneapolis, and I remember going there and being in the big meeting on Friday night. And for somebody who had been afraid of crowds, that was amazing to be there. And I remember how thrilled I was to be in that environment and how just wonderful it felt. And I remember crying there just to be a part of something like that. So if there's anybody here who hasn't been to a big meeting yet, just wait till tonight. You'll see what I'm talking about. It's still a thrill every time I step into one of those big meetings. I think a lot of us think that we can never dance if we get sober. Well, for me, that really wasn't an issue because I was a terrible dancer when I was drinking. I never had the ability to dance. So after I had been sober a few years, well, actually, this was just a few years ago, my husband and I, in our travels, would see people dancing, and we'd think, wouldn't it be neat to be able to do that? So we started taking ballroom dance lessons, and we've been taking them for several years now. And guess what? I have found out that I actually am a pretty good dancer. Yeah. The only thing I had to do was ask for help and also practice little tiny baby steps. In addition to the dancing for fun, other things we do is we go to a lot of plays and we go to a lot of concerts. In fact, just a week ago yesterday, we were at a Jimmy Buffett concert. I want you to know there were a lot of people wasting away in Margaritaville. A Jimmy Buffett concert is one great big party, not unlike this convention, with a few little differences, of course. So how do I do it? How do I go to a Jimmy Buffett concert sober? Well, I got out that toolbox that I got way back when I first got sober. And some of the tools I used are, one, I never would have tried to do something like that when I was new in sobriety. I really think it's important to have a firm foundation in sobriety before putting myself in that kind of an environment. Secondly, I never would have gone to something like that if it was just me surrounded by a bunch of people drinking. I always go with at least one other sober person, and if I'm in a group of sober people, it's even better. I also do something like that in addition to, not in place of meetings. I believe that meeting makers make it, and every time I think that I'm doing so good, I don't need these meetings anymore, I have to remember I'm doing good because of these meetings. So what I did was I went to a meeting the day before we went to the concert, and after we got back from the concert, I went the next day to another meeting. And finally, I always ask my higher power for help. I don't think it matters what our higher power is. We all have different concepts of what our higher power is, but I think it's really important to rely on our higher power, whatever it may be, and use it to help get through times like that. You know, my very first sponsor used to say, today I'm living the life that I used to sit on a bar stool and dream about. I used to hear her say that and I would be so jealous. I think I'll never be at a point where I'll be able to say that. But today I am at that point. I can say that. Today I am really living the life that I once just sat on a bar stool and dreamed about. And like it says here in the book, living sober turns out to be not at all grim, boring, and uncomfortable as we had feared, but rather something we begin to enjoy and find much more exciting than our drinking days. How true it is. Thank you.
Our next speaker is from Florida. Please welcome. Someone else is from Florida? Get over it. Our next speaker is from Florida. Please welcome Lisa L.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lisa Lambrinos, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank GS Eva for organizing this whole convention and for reaching out to some people that she knew, I guess she could count on to show up and do the right thing. You know, that's what I've been taught from the beginning of my sobriety, and that was to show up, be well-groomed, amicable, and pleasant. And I want to thank Buck for leading the meeting. I want to definitely thank Karen and Mike, and I want to thank all of you. I want to also congratulate Mike on 15 big ones and Jackie on 13. Way to go, guys. Let's keep taking it a day at a time here. My parents didn't drink. I'm the youngest of three. My name is Lisa Lambrinos. I'm an alcoholic. I said that. I just want to make sure. And it's an honor and a privilege to be here. I'm here on the prayers and on the shoulders of many people who were willing to listen to me at the diner with a cup of coffee after the meeting, even the meeting before the meeting. And I just want to thank my fiancé, Kevin Sullivan, for this cup of coffee and for all that he does for us and for me. Kevin, where'd you go? okay, in 20 minutes or less, I just want to say a little bit about what happened, what it was like, and what it's like today. I got sober in the Pacific Group my first 5 years of sobriety. I'm so grateful for the roots and the foundation there. And then after that, I moved to New York City for the last 20 years. And I want to thank the Atlantic Group for continuing to carry that strong message of sobriety and action. In the last 6.5 months, I moved to the Villages in Florida. And I just have got to thank the group down there that has been so generous of heart and spirit and time and energy to be willing to take both Kevin and I in and be so loving and friendly and let us take commitments from the get-go. Because Marlena says, Lisa, it's great that you're going to go retire down in the Villages, but there's only so much pickleball, golf, and swimming and, volleyball that you can play. You got to get out there and you got to get busy and get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was right. And it's held me in good stead to this moment. So I'm the youngest of three. My parents didn't drink. And living sober to me was a concept that I didn't understand. I just got to tell you that I had no clue about living sober. I drank for 12 years. I was in dry in Al-Anon. I quit everything cold turkey and went to Al-Anon and, for a brother in 1985 and did not get the program in Al-Anon. I gave the program of Al-Anon complete and utter lip service. I want to thank my sponsor, Marlena, too, before I forget. I don't know where she is. She's here somewhere. But I want to thank my sponsor, Marlena B. I also want to say... But all three siblings drank. My parents didn't, but all three of us did. And, I hit a bottom after 12 years of drinking, and I was a binge drinker. And I went into a rehab, which isn't everybody's story. You don't need to go to rehab. Alcoholics Anonymous works great. And I just didn't know what the heck I was. I brought myself in literally for an emotional problem. And the third day I was there, when I was describing my drinking, they said, Lisa, you've never had a social drink. You may have started socially for about 6 months to a year, and then after that you were just, you know, it was just however much I could drink, how often I could drink. I was not discriminatory about what I drank. I just drank for effect. And so that was it, you know, and I crashed and burned in a very short period of time. And then I went to Al-Anon because of my binge drinking. I could control everything. I thought that I didn't have a problem because I could control and I could binge drink. I thought that meant that I wasn't an alcoholic, is what I'm trying to say there. And so after I got into rehab, after 3 days, they said, Lisa, you've never really drank socially. You were just, you know, all out, just drink. And you know, I said, okay. I said, what the heck am I going to do now? I thought I had a mental problem. You know, just give me some of those, you know, pills you want to give me, or some of those yum-yums that doctors are just handing out like crazy, and we'll just try to get the right cocktail going for me, and that'll take care of the problem. You know, and for me, that was not the case. I went into AA I went to rehab, and then I went to a halfway, and then I went to a three-quarter way, and I'm so fortunate that everybody was very strong. Everybody was extremely strong with me, and I didn't even know I needed strong people in front of me, because I was a very strong person that was afraid. And so I had a very strong outer shell, but a very tender, I guess, inside shell, I think. I'm not really on the pulse of my situation that much, but I have a feeling that my higher power was again guiding me and put people in front of me that were strong enough and were willing to help me in spite of how I felt. I had the first person literally put their hand in the small of my back and said, Lisa, we understand how you feel. We understand. I came in with a whole list, a litany of problems. They put their hand in the small of my back and guided me over to the coffee making table and said, this is what you're going to start doing now. You're going to make coffee. I was able to step outside of myself and begin the process of not thinking about Lisa. I had not had a break for myself in years. I was completely self-absorbed. I did not know how to stop doing that. And this was the first interruption of that. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know how to even make coffee. So I was dry in Al-Anon. I was starting to have audiovisual. I was praying for purification. Literally, I was burning frankincense. I had Todd Rundgren's Healing album on. You know, and after 30 days, like I said, I know I backed up. I went to a halfway, and every step of the way, it was God guided, I believe, without even knowing it. I look back for half a second, you know, and I say to myself, it has to be, right up into this moment. And luckily, the people in AA were not afraid to hurt my feelings. They were not afraid to tell me about myself. And I couldn't even spell Betsy, my first sponsor in Monterey, Betsy B. in Monterey Peninsula. God bless her soul and spirit. Pray for her every day. She taught me how to spell Betsy. I spelled it B-E-S-T-Y. She goes, no, Lisa, just look at that again. I was so mocus, even from 5 years being in Al-Anon, I got the gift of step none. I did have a sponsor in Al-Anon that after a year, she goes, Lisa, I've taught you everything I know. You got to go do the program of AA now. Or you got to go do the program of Al-Anon. At least go live it. A living problem. I didn't know how to live sober, whether I was in Al-Anon or come to find out even in AA. I did not know how to live. I was so afraid. And I did everything to not look that way. I worked double time trying to not look like I didn't know how to live my life. And it was a full-time job, I'll tell you. And so when I did get to AA, they said, you're fault-finding. Jean K., my second sponsor in the Pacific group, she said, Lisa, God bless Jean. She's now Jean H., but if anybody knows her, Claremont, California. She said, Lisa, you're fault-finding, negative, domineering, and controlling. Stop it now. From this day forward, no more. She goes, I'm keeping an eye on you, kiddo, because guess what? You're not going to be able to have a life. You're not going to be able to live. And I had no, any good therapist, any good psychotherapist, any good counseling that I think I brought myself to, nobody was willing to talk to me like the people here in AA. And they nipped it in the bud for me, right from the gate. They spoke the truth. Yes, it may have hurt my ego, but you know what? Too bad. Too bad. I didn't need that kind of coddling. I just didn't need that kind of coddling. Not me. And she saved my life by telling me that. I really believe that. I mean, it may not sound that way to you, but that's what I needed. I was thinking I was pulling one over on you guys all the time. Let me see. So she said, you're going to get a job, kid, and you're going to go to meetings, and you're going to have a commitment at every meeting. Okay? So I stopped thinking about myself. That was a miracle in it. For me to have any kind of break from that was such an incredible thing. You know, I got involved in the Pacific group. I just had no idea who I had asked to be my sponsor when I asked Jean K to be my sponsor. She was just doing endless service. She was going through a divorce. She had three children, young kids. I mean, she was sewing dresses for people in AA that were just dropping groceries off. They remained nameless. We would just be in the back of the house. We'd come in. There'd be like four grocery bags on the counter waiting for her because they knew she was on hard times. They knew that she needed groceries, you know, and people just did it for fun and for free. They helped each other. That's what we do here. We help each other. And I didn't have a clue how to live my life, and I was starting to take commitments in AA. I got a full-time job and went to school full-time. They said, you're going to start there, and you're going to build from there. And it was an inside job. I had a sponsor, like I said, Betsy B. on the Peninsula. We worked all 12 steps. They made me treasurer in 6 months before I moved down to Southern California. And I had no idea how to be a treasurer at 6 months of sobriety. They said, calm down. Don't worry about it. We're going to show you. I got a checking account. You know, I never knew how to do that. That was like, I felt like I was grandfathered in the whole time. It was like one big grandfathering in of how to live my life. And so I learned how to do that. I worked the steps. I started to work with people. I don't know how effective I was as a newbie in AA, but I tried. I showed up. I tried to listen to people. I tried to share with them specifically and graciously what I had learned, you know, for fun and for free. And little light bulbs started to go off. You know where they started to go off? At the diner after the meeting. The belly laughs started to happen at the diner after the meeting for me. The first belly laughs ever. Real laughing. Real laughter without any pretense, without any inebriation for me. I just couldn't believe it. I didn't even know it was possible. And then I moved to Southern California. I got a full-time job at Nordstrom's working for Estee Lauder with my girl Michelle over here, who I haven't seen in 25 years. But as God would have it, I would sit right in front of her today and we would find each other after all that and come to find out she's sober. And we just had a blast there. And she was going through a rough patch. But, you know, whenever we were at work together, we had fun, and that was so joyful for me to see her today. And then I graduated from there, and I got to just tell you, the people in AA said to me, Lisa, you don't know how to live. You don't know how to do this life that we're talking about here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw the sparkle in your eye, and I knew you had something that I didn't have. I couldn't believe it. I was riddled with fear. I was riddled with attitude. I was still trying to protect myself from all of you guys because there's no way you could possibly know how to live this life. There was no way. Not the people in AA. You know, I had 2 or 3 degrees. You know, what did you have? No degree? You know, or a certificate? I don't know. Either way, I was that afraid that I had so much judgment still, and I was still trying to walk through it. I was still trying to take direction. I would try to be polite, say, oh, okay, you know, I'll try and do that. Okay, no problem, you know. And I don't even know, they said, don't worry about it, Lisa, sincerity is not a requirement. You know, you just, and thank God they told me that, because if I was, you know, waiting around for that, I would have never really, it wouldn't have happened, because I just thought, oh, you know, there were so much therapeutic things going on where, you know, your authentic self, what the, if I waited around for the authentic self to show up, there would never have been any kind of life that I've been able to somehow, with God's help and a higher power. The steps went into me by working those steps, and they helped me to have a life on the outside of my house, outside the four walls of my home. You know, Clancy talked to me. He said, Lisa, you're going to put your shoes on every day, your socks, your shoes, and you're going to get dressed and go out there. And you're going to try to go live in the world with some degree of harmony and peacefulness and gratitude. And he said, and by the way, while you're at it, shape up your attitude. I had never no one ever talked to me like that. No one ever said, shape up, kid. You know, and I was like, well, wait a minute. Shape up, kid. I'm doing the right thing. I got a commitment over here. You know, I went to work today. I went to class. You know, I did what I was supposed to do. So what do you mean shape up? You know, I mean, really, it took me a while. And, you know, the slow recovery was also something that I heard when I came in. I wish people a slow recovery. I mean, I don't have anything earth-shattering to say here. It's just the same thing that we were given when we first came in. It hasn't really changed that much. You know, a slow recovery. I have sponsees that want to be on step 8 in, like, the second week of sobriety. I mean, I guess there's nothing wrong with that. It's just not how I had it. I took 1 year to do all 12 steps, and that's just how I got sober. Let's see, what else? You know, I had to learn how to live with a degree of humility and gratitude in the world on a daily basis. I did not know how to leave. I knew how to leave the house. I just didn't know how to be one of many in the room with all of you. I still thought that I had to tell you what to do. I thought that I had to give you guidance. Oh, no, we're supposed to do it that way. I started telling somebody upstairs about, you know, how they need to put 2 shelves of water in the cooler because they ran out of water after 1 hour. I go, can you guys do 2 shelves of water? She doesn't need my suggestion, you know? I got to tell you that the steps and my sobriety and service and action, that's all I know. I don't really know much more than that. I mean, I'm not going to even try to come up with something new here. It has been any action and service that I can participate in has been the thing that, as an alcoholic, my alcoholism wants me to be so self-involved, and AA has asked me to do the opposite. I had to walk through anxiety. If I'm depressed, I feel depressed. If I feel happy, I'm happy. If I'm not, whatever, it's just, you know, you walk through it like life on life terms, let's say. And it was just a natural state, not one where, thank you. Thank you very much. And not one where you have any pretense about it. And you just learn how to cope. My coper was broken. It kept me from living. It kept me from being out there with all of you and having joy in my life. And the joy is also very, very important. I sang for the last 8 years with a group at Carnegie Hall. I moved to New York 20 years ago to try to be an opera singer, and I had really privileged training. But when it came down to it for me to start traveling in Europe and making the auditions, I was not interested in leaving the United States of America. And 20 years ago, a lot of opera singers were making their career not on American soil. It was always on European grounds. So I just... You know what? I was a school teacher for the last 14 years for the Board of Ed, And it was a very adverse situation. I started in Hollis, Queens. So God, you know, had a wonderful sense of humor and knew that it was time for me to move on with a career after slinging grease over there at Estee Lauder for a little while. And it was time to go and, you know, train for the opera singer. That's fine, Lisa. Go try and do that. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with trying to get in the classroom and share those gifts that you've learned in all of your training. And it's been an honor. It's been an honor and a privilege. My life today is beyond my wildest dreams right up until this minute in this room with all of you. I cannot believe how many people, you know, have come out to support me today just because, I mean, half the people here have already heard me share. They know my story. They don't need to hear it again. But they came because they wanted to be supportive. I just can't even believe it. I'm humbled by that and extremely grateful. Kevin proposed to me on my birthday on February 14th, and we're getting married on October 17th. It's my first marriage. And I didn't think that there was ever a possibility even on the horizon for a relationship. If you're new or if you're coming back, I just want to welcome you. This is an amazing experience not to be missed. Like it talks about in the big book, that there will be a host of friends that will grow up around you. I was like, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean? That just like sounded like AA jargon or a cliche or something that really didn't hit a nerve with me. It's an experience not to be missed, right, with a host of friends. And I just can't even imagine that would ever come to pass or for me to be able to experience that even. And it has been that times 20. You know what I mean? That times 100. And let me think what else. I can't say enough about the steps and prayer and reaching out to other people and sponsorship and being willing to continue to be sponsored, because I thought at almost 25 years of sobriety that I was supposed to know everything now. I don't know if anybody else felt that way. At 25 years of sobriety in September 17th, by the way, I thought that I was supposed to know some stuff. You know, like, oh, I don't really need to ask my sponsor Marlena that anymore, or I shouldn't need her in certain ways like that anymore, or I should have, like, certain things figured out. It's amazing how my thinking is still a little bit askew. But a lot clearer, I can assure you of that, to know that indeed I do need to keep reaching out. I do need to keep asking for help. I do need to keep going to meetings and reaching out to other people and not have this thing figured out. It's a wonderful experience. It's been a freedom and a happiness not to know. It's been a freedom and a happiness not to know, because I really thought that I had to know so much stuff. And I don't have to worry about it anymore. I get to pray about it and let it go. I just can't even believe I'm telling you that, because I really wanted to control a lot of things. And to be relieved of it, you know, and to not have to worry about it and let go and let God. I just have to thank all of you and for Buck for leading such a great meeting. And it's an honor and a privilege to be here. I love being sober. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love my fiancé, Kevin Sullivan. And I'm thrilled and honored to be here. Thank you for my sobriety and thank you for coming.
When you're asked to chair a meeting at the International Convention, you don't know the people that will be speaking. And prior to the meeting, you get to introduce yourself. You already know where everybody's from, and you ask a few questions like how long you're sober. So I meet the two lovely ladies, and they're just fascinating people, and I get a chance to how long you're sober, where you're from, where's your home group. And then the next speaker comes up the steps, and he's wearing a flag-like shirt. And I thought to myself, well, that's pretty good at the International. This weekend it's July 4th. In this country, that's in Independence Day, and in Great Britain, it's Thanksgiving. So so this guy's going to play the crowd. He's a really nice guy with a long-term sobriety. Please meet our third and final speaker, Michael B. from California.
Good Mike, alcoholic. Well, here we are, right in the center of the earth. It's true, wherever we are, that's where it's all happening, right? Some of you guys are going, I'm not going to show up, I stick around for the bald guy at the end. There's probably a better meeting. There was a guy earlier standing over here who says, I'm going to go check another meeting out. If it's no good, I'm going to come back. Well, what makes it good? I asked him, what makes it good? Oh, I don't know. I want to be spiritual. So, for those who stuck around, this is as good as it's going to get. I want you to know I ran this morning 5 miles, and I went by the Martin Luther King thing. If you haven't been there, it's incredible. This city is seated in contemplation for what's occurred in our history as people on the planet, United States and all that. But that center is absolutely beautiful, and the dedication to Martin Luther King, and for us to learn how to live with tolerance with each other. So take time to go over and see that if you can. But I drank a bunch of water after that, and right now I've got to pee like a racehorse. So if I offended somebody with the words racehorse, then I apologize. So if you're planning on hugging me afterwards, you may get wet. I'll wear this shirt later with the Mickey Mouse on the bottom. It's not just a shirt, but Mickey Mouse is on the bottom. I'm an overgrown child. And I got sober when I was 21, and now I'm 30 years sober. And I go to Disneyland a lot. I live in California, and I'm the biggest kid there. And I just won't grow up here, and I'm not going to do it, so forget it. Nor should I. I don't know about you, but I have a question for you. Are you dreaming about or doing the things that you dreamt about when you were a kid? Because Thoreau says most people live a quiet desperation of their life, never getting to where they want to be. And that can happen to us here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes we get here because we just want to get the drink problem solved. And we get into meetings, we go to meetings, we don't drink, and we listen to our sponsors, and they tell us what to do. And if you're like me, where I was about 2.5 years sober, and I was dying from untreated alcoholism. Untreated alcoholism looks kind of like page 52, where I was having troubles with personal relationships. I was a prey to misery and depression. Had huge emotional displacement. Couldn't be a real help to other people. And the one that really got me is I was unhappy and I was full of fear. And I'm sitting there listening and reading the promises at the end of the meeting going, that sounds good for you, but that's not what's happening for me. Where's mine? How come I'm not getting it? And I came here, you know, I grew up in Southern California on the beach where the Beach Boys are from. Anybody heard of the Beach Boys before? All right. I've met those guys. Some of them are friends of mine. I've met them. There's a great movie out right now called Love and Mercy about Brian Wilson and mental illness. Great movie. But it's about how our perceptions are and how we live. And most of all, it's about our brokenness. And I came into AA thinking, you know, if I just don't drink and go to meetings and do what they tell me what to do, I'll just get better. I'll sit next to the old crusty guys. You know who you are. I didn't say anything. But, you know, if you sit next to the old crusty guys, we might just get it. But after a while, after going to 800 meetings my first year and 800 meetings the second year, I was miserable in Alcoholics Anonymous, wondering, when's this going to get better? Well, just go, you know, pick up ashtrays and carry newcomers to meetings. And you know, finally, after a while, my sponsor says, you're not carrying the message, you're spreading manure. Because maybe you don't know what you're doing here. But I didn't get that sponsor right away because I sat in meetings thinking, gee, I wish I could get this thing. Where's mine? I'd get to the meetings and I'd go down the street about a mile away. And next thing you know, road rage started happening. And I was afraid I wasn't making enough money and I couldn't make a living. And I couldn't seem to solve this inner voice that said, am I missing something here? And then at nighttime, when you had to get up for work at 6 a.m. in the morning or had to be at an important thing, you'd lay there with your mind going, what's wrong with me? How come I can't get it right? Darn it. And sweat's running down your leg. And you're thinking, please, God, just let me go to sleep. I'm tired of thinking about myself. And I would do this for a long time. I was churning. And I would say, okay, we'll go to a meeting. Go help somebody. But at some point, I got to a point where that unhappiness and that fear inside of me wasn't being solved. I'd done some inventory. I'd done an inventory was like a checkbox thing from, you know, one of these treatment centers. And I'd written a couple of things I had done and made some I'm sorry amends. But it wasn't making the conversion that I needed. It wasn't doing it for me. And when I got to that point where I was really desperate with some of my friends where we couldn't work the program, so we'd go out afterwards and eat a bunch of sugar and play video games and try to figure out what was next. Smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, go to Denny's and argue about God in Denny's, you know. Anybody ever go to Denny's late at night and argue about God? And offend the other normal people around you? Excuse me, sir, could you not say the F word and God all in the same sentence? F you, lady. Now let me tell you about God. I'm going to get this thing. We go to the wrist slashers meeting at the midnight meeting trying to figure out what to do with ourselves. See if you could get laid. Maybe someone will redeem you for getting laid. You know. I was 21. How are you going to have any fun with the rest of your life if you're getting sober at 21? That was a question I had. And this old crusty guy in the meeting, which those guys always have a little wisdom, leaned over and said, dude, I've heard your story. How much fun can you possibly stand? You know, how am I alcoholic at 21? Some people are like, well, I spilled more alcohol than you ever drank. Well, if you hadn't spilled so much, you probably would have gotten here sooner. So I'm a young person in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of you may have heard of Icky Paw or Acky Paw or Ticky Paw or Zicky Paw or Icky, whatever paw it is. Those people are part of the grassroots of Alcoholics Anonymous. People have told us you're too young to be here, and I'm here to tell you there's no way. I've been broken long before I ever took a drink. I was broken long before I ever took alcohol. Because if a spaceship would have landed in my backyard, a little green man would have got out and said, dude, the reason you feel so separate and apart from is because you're not from here, that would have made a lot of sense to me. Because I always felt different and apart from. I swear, you guys got up earlier in the morning before I did, and when I went to school, you know, my school work, and you guys all said, when you see Mike today, tell him what a lousy job he's doing. That's how bad I felt about myself. And I thought, you know, well, okay, so I got to be part of the in crowd. So I started listening to Led Zeppelin, Kansas, Cheap Trick, Molly Hatchet, and above all, Pink Floyd. We don't need no education. Right? That was perfect for me. I don't need this stuff. What am I doing here? This is ridiculous. These people are nuts. They don't feel like I feel. In fact, I had a chance to go see Pink Floyd when I was 17, and my friend begged me to go. It was 30 minutes down the road, and I didn't go because I didn't know who the hell they were. Then I heard the Wall album about 2 weeks later and went, holy crap, I just missed one of the best things on the planet. And I want to tell you, about 2 years ago, Pink Floyd was in town, Roger Waters doing the Wall, and I took my 13-year-old son with me, and we watched Pink Floyd together. Now, maybe that's not a big deal to you, but I'm a single dad who had a mother who tried everything in the book to get rid of me 12 years ago. My friend Dennis is here. He knows. She tried everything. You know what I've had to do for 13 years living sober? Fight to be a dad. I've had to stand in courtrooms and take accusation that wasn't true and pray to God for help and go to sponsors and go to therapists and become the person I've always wanted to be, which is a responsible man who could be a mentor to a young man and teach him how to live. And I've had to do that, and that kid just texted me a few minutes ago and wished me luck for being here today. He's my teacher. You want to learn how to sponsor somebody? Have a child. When people come in, it would be really appropriate if we just threw people on a table and changed their diapers. You think I'm joking? Look at yourself. That's about as good as I could do, shit my pants and get to AA. I'm serious. It was bad. I just wanted to not feel as bad as I did. I'm one of those guys that was also doing those other little powdery things that helped raise my bottom so I could get here earlier. Peeking out the curtains, ordering Domino's for the fifth time, trying to get a courier to get the next pile and go get... And then we were at parties where they put ashes inside the beer. I was siphoning the ashes out of the beer so I could just get another drink. Changing clocks at Cork and Bottle, arguing with the guy. It's not 5 o'clock, it's 6 o'clock. Look at the clock. When you're tall and you're big, you can change clocks at liquor stores and argue all day with some Korean guy that's telling you go to jail, you get out of here. And then I come back at 6:01 and say, dude, I told you it was 6 o'clock, now give me my beer. I mean, I was desperate. I wanted this stuff. I could not stop. So the description of the alcoholic for me is I did drink. And the reason I drank is because I kept drinking because I have the physical allergy to alcohol that's described in the doctor's opinion. But you take away alcohol for me, and I come into AA for 2 years and 6 months, and the mental obsession was not solved. But more importantly, what I was suffering from was a spiritual malady. Ill will. Resentment. Resentment and fear is our number one things about ill will. I used to think inventory was about, and I've done about 12 inventories now in my 30 years. But inventory I thought was about, I'd write down all the stuff I did wrong and then I'd go tell people I'm sorry and then I'd be better. And inventory is not about that. It's my first step on paper. It's where I gave power away. It's where I gave my power, my life to people, places, and things. What you thought of me, how you felt of me was more important than what I thought or what I felt of me. What I found out also in AA is this is not a place that we just come here to do better. We need to learn how to think, not what to think. We spent a lot of time in AA parroting, trying to say what other people said. I'm telling you, AA is a great place to get well, but it's also a place, great place to get sick. Some people don't like that. They think I'm putting AA down. I'm not. AA has nothing to do with this. AA has nothing to do with my recovery if I'm not willing to do some work. But I heard that sponsor talk about untreated alcoholism, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and the first thing he asked me after 2.5 years and doing a little bit of work and clearly had a lot of knowledge about myself, he said, are you willing to start over? And I said, I'm looking for the answers, he said. He goes, well, good. There's no answers in the book. Good luck. Call me when you're ready to listen. So I called him a couple days later, and I said, what do you mean there's no answers in the book? We hear it all the times in the program. And he goes, yeah, that's another one of those half-truths that's being told in AA. He goes, I'm going to show you something here. If you're willing to follow my lead for a while, because I can't fix you, you can call me. I'll hear your problems, but I can't fix you. All I can do is show you how this was done for me. And what I heard out of that man was an attraction of being able to get to something inside him that was accessible. You know, I don't know what that guy was asking about earlier, what makes the best meeting, but my home group's the men's crosstalk meeting on Thursday nights. You start talking about your dog, your cat, or your job, or your wife, or your girlfriend, we're going to stop you. Because that's not the program. That's a story. And when we do that, we ask you, what step are you on? What was your instructions? Do you have a step guide or a sponsor? When was the last time you met with them? And what's been your experience on that step you're working? We do a step a week, and we rotate through the 12 steps. But we start to learn how to think and not what to think. And by the questions that are indicated in our book, I begin to get to a place where I start to look at, do I have this thing? Really? Do I know what it means? The description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent questions. A, am I alcoholic? And do I have this thing? Is my life unmanageable? What does that mean? I thought unmanageability meant you had a nasty sock drawer or your checking account sucked. I found out my unmanageability is I don't know how to go to God. I have no idea how to go to God. And at 30 years sober, I'm still agnostic at times. I'll take it from here. God, I got it. Thank you very much. And I do that blindly. One of the big things about my alcoholism is I'm blind to myself. I don't see myself. The step process is about getting to a power greater than ourselves, which will solve our problem, it tells us. But my mind jumps in and says, so I can solve my problem. It's not about me getting to God so I can solve my problem. It's about me getting to God so He can solve my problem. And that's been the journey here for these 30 years. It's been that struggle. It's been that struggle where I think, I'll take it from here, God. You can just wait. And I don't even say it out loud. I don't even know. So the rest of the work, step four is the first step on paper. Reading the inventory, I get to bring myself from out from behind the bottle. Alcohol is not my problem. Our book says it's not our problem. If you think it's your problem, okay. But for me, the real alcoholic, it says that our problem is we suffer from a lack of power. And how do we get that power? Well, that's exactly what that book's about. This program's about. It's about finding a power greater than ourselves which will solve the problem. The rest of the work is about finding a power greater than ourselves which will solve our problem. There's no answers in the book. The questions are to me. The first step is an excavation. It's an inquiry. It's a place I look in the warehouse of my life and say, how did I get here? And I'm here to tell you also, if you are not in the program and you're suffering and you're having a rough time, it's not your fault. Because it's just not about drinking and going to meetings. There's three sides of our triangle and our circle and our triangle. There's the traditions. I thought the traditions were for the group, but the steps were for the individual. The traditions are for me to learn how to live life and deal with the rest of the world. For me to be self-supporting through my own contributions and everything I'm doing. That God goes with me in the third tradition. There's no one out there bigger than God. There ain't no boss, there ain't no president, there ain't no leader of the world. The only one I need to focus on is what I think of me. That's the gift that gets given to you. Doesn't matter what other people think of you either. It only matters what I think of me. So one of the gifts from the doing the steps, and I thought making amends, when you got to amends, it was about saying you're sorry. Yeah, there's apologies due. But making amends means to mend, to clean up. And most of all, what amends says is to be of maximum service to God and to our fellows. It says it right there. Our purpose is to be of maximum service to God and to our fellows. So that journey has taken me on lots of different things. I've been able to meet a few presidents of the United States. I got involved with a lot of different things. I got my education after I got here. I got my 4-year degree and I got my education. That was really a lifelong dream. Wanted to do that. Been able to get a good business. I've had business go in and business go out. Several years back, I was calling for people to ask for money to help me get going. Because I went through the economy and went through a hard time. I was at a point where I got up in the morning, I didn't want to get up. Because of the custody stuff and all the stuff that was going on. But it just kept saying, the sponsor, and one-on-one sponsorship is the number one thing that'll save me as an alcoholic. The sponsorship, home group, where they ask questions. How are you doing, Mike? What step are you on? Where are you at? What's the work? And then most of all, how's God doing for you? There has been times in long-term sobriety where God is not here. One of the things that I've also had to learn how to do is to have emotional sobriety. Wake up to myself. Learn how to have feelings. Understand what they are. So I've had to go to the therapeutic route to learn from people that know these things. We're not doctors here. And if there are people here that are on medication, and I'm not on medication, but people ask that, but there are people on medication or seeing therapists and stuff like that, you keep going there because those are people that we are not. Get out there and see those people if you have to. Do whatever it takes. Get all in. This is my 6th world convention. And I am as new gets. I am grateful to be sober. More than I've ever been. When I got to 30 years in December, I woke up in the morning and came to tears. I'm like, oh my God, 30 years, that's like for old guys. But there's no choice. I got sober at 21 and I said I'll stay sober forever. I have a vision that one day I'll have 100 years sober. 80 years sober. I'll be 101 years old. I'll go to the meeting and I'll go to my hotel room and die. And then they can figure out what to do with my body. Here's a couple things I want to say before I get down. Don't miss anything. Don't miss your kids. I watch people in here get bitter at their kids and get bitter at their families. Go to Al-Anon. It works for alcoholics too. And don't come up here and tell me this isn't an Al-Anon meeting. AA is a family recovery thing. Don't let your story about how hard it is for sobriety to get in the way of your recovery. I want to share that with you from my heart. Do not let your story, what happened, and now we got here and then sit down. Please stop doing that. Talk about how you're struggling in your sobriety, how you're trying to find a way, how you're trying to get a better job. Get better. Don't ask God to make it easier. Ask God to make it better. How can I be better? Get educated. This takes skill. Working the steps is a skill set. There's learning to be done. How to use it. How to get to God. There's lots of people out there. This Martin Luther King guy, man, boy, what a visionary that guy. Let's talk about humanity and getting to God. He's got Gandhi out in the front of his location there. Be the change you want to see. Study those people that are out there making the change in the world. Take this to the streets. Take your sobriety quietly and go out in the world and take it to the streets. Let people know quietly they'll come about. You'll be surprised how many people will come about. They'll just say it. People are hungry for God. They're hungry for the Spirit. You know what we're all hungry for? It's for people to recognize the gift we are. We're a gift. This is a gift. Sobriety is a gift and life is a gift. We get caught up in what other people think or turn the news off. Do a 30-day mental cleanse. My mentor helps me. He's not even in the program. Teach me how to do a 30-day mental cleanse. Turn the news off. Stop reading the internet. Stop being in fear. Stop listening to negative people and don't be negative. Read spiritual books and come home to yourself. Give yourself a chance to quiet down the chatter so you can hear this amazing spirit that's in you. And then go back into your community and show people the gift they are. People are living in quiet desperation, hoping that someday someone will say, wow, my life matters. One of the greatest gifts I have is being a dad. And I left the other day and my kid kissed me. And I can still feel the kiss on my cheek. Because someone taught me to be in the moment. Be present to what you have. Look to the left. And look to the right. Those are the miracles. We're the miracles. We're miracles because we're sober. We're miracles because we're human beings sober. And look at this. We were at the dance last night. Anybody go to the dance with the band? Oh, my. I was down there in tears. And one lady says, are you okay? I said, you're damn right, man. I'm at the World Convention rubbing up against a large-breasted woman, listening to a band, having a blast, going, man, this is my sixth convention. I'm a human being alive on the planet at 52 years old because Alcoholics Anonymous saved a sick guy like me and showed me how to take my sickened spirit, focus out, and help other people. And be able to come here and enjoy it. And that's what we're here for. So go for your dreams. Go for what you want. Stay sober. Get that sponsor. Learn how to work the step process from the question, not from the answer. And I guarantee you, you'll live a life that is totally worth living. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a few minutes until the end of the meeting, and we have some microphones up here, and we'll entertain those people who have some comments. And to those of you who are leaving, thank you for joining us today. We'll have 2 minutes on the clock for those who wish to share. I'm reminded for those from Florida, will be a minute 15 seconds. And is anyone at the first microphone? Yes, ma'am. Please introduce yourself. And please.
Hi, my name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jackie.
My home group is the Atlanta Group in New York City. I always want to say thank you for leading a great meeting. I want to say, Lisa, awesome. You hit it out of the park today. It was really, really good.
Excuse me for just a second.
Yes.
Pardon me. Ladies and gentlemen, those of you who are leaving, we have a meeting going on, and we ask that you leave quietly. We can't hear the person speaking at the microphone. Young lady,
Hi.
Could you start over, please, and introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Take two. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
thank you for your service. Thank you for this awesome meeting and the great topic. And Karen, Lisa, I love you. Mike, I have a question for you. You described how to detox from the news and get a little I'm just wondering, what's your spiritual practice on a day-to-day basis? And how do you get that conscious contact with God? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank God for being here right now. Because this is my moment. This is your moment. So that's part of my spiritual practice. I have become more aware of the tenth step. I talked about a few years back having trouble with money and the custody and it just got to the point where it was so difficult. And I knew I was going to stay sober, but it was living. And one of my sponsors, I asked God, show me where to go, God. Trust. See, one of the gifts here is we get access to a power greater than ourselves, which will solve our problems. So I have to keep in the self-talk. Thy will not mine be done is one of our tools, we say. God, help me to see this right now. I'll be talking to myself, not on myself, but talking to myself. And people are like, my son will even say, who are you talking to? I said, I'm talking to God right now. Because I'm struggling internally. So God, help me to see what it can do. Help me to be in touch with it. Help me to be in the moment. Spirituality means the breath of life. So breathing is real important. I was telling Lisa up here earlier, keep breathing. You know, I know we're up here. It's important to us. Hopefully it's important to you, but it is for us. I can tell you all three of us are nervous. Why? Because we're anticipating God's grace. Now, I don't always see it that way. I'm like, oh my God, they're judging me, and I'm not going to say it right, or I'm going to fail. Well, the good news is I'm already failed. So how would I live my life differently if I knew I could not fail? And how I do that is say, God, I got this moment now. So in the morning, yeah, there's the 10th and 11th step has those phrases, those tools. When paused or agitated or doubtful, take a breath. Shut off the chatter. Wait, it may take a few minutes. Bill Wilson talks about it in As Bill Sees It. I ask God for the answer. If it comes, great. I do it. If it doesn't come, I ask again. If it doesn't come again, I ask again. But if I don't, then I weigh out, okay, what would be the most useful thing here for me to be, to help others, to help myself? Because it's not about me losing me. Altruism in the program is about doing something for the benefit of all concerned. Now, I'm saying all these things to you because that's the awareness that I've been able to hear. And I'm sharing to you in a potent minute here, that's what I have awareness of. So my awareness is important. The key to change is being aware. So my awareness of who I am, my role, what I'm doing, is so important to me recognizing God's grace in my life. And when it goes along, I was listening to Lisa, I was getting jealous of her because she's just hot looking and she's nice. And her husband's over there, that's fine. And I'm thinking, wish she'd shut up because I got to get up there. And I said, you know what, God, I love the blessing that Lisa's here today. Thank you. Bless the things I want. And quietly I get jealous. That quiet desperation, I wish I had something, whatever it is. And I've learned to say, God, bless that. Hopefully I have that someday. So when I bless what I'm jealous over, bless what I hate, then it just frees me up. I don't know if I'm helping you or not.
Thank you, you did.
Right on.